Hello and welcome to Real Professional, the podcast where real professionals have really professional conversations about the gaming industry. I'm DreadXP Rock on Tour, Jan Solstrom, joined today, as always, by head of production, Ted Hinchke. Say hi, Ted.
Hello, everyone.
Also joined by assistant producer, Abby Smith, a.k.a. Scruncho. Say hi, Abby.
Hello.
And our guest today is haunted PS1 developer, Highwall, Bluepold creator, Jamathan. Say hi, Jamathan.
Hello.
It's going to be a good time.
Jamathan.
It's going to be a good time, so DJ, drop that sick beat.
Speed drops.
Okay, so we've been doing pretty consistent podcasting, so I hope that you all are feeling pretty safe from the gamer safety updates that you have received.
I have managed to change several key factors of my life thanks to the gamer safety updates, and I feel significantly, at least if not safer, more terrified, which I think is the state every gamer strives for nowadays. Mm-hmm.
Ted just sitting in an empty room, no office chair, can't sit down because his lung might collapse, can't put on a VR headset, he might break his neck. I've been
boarding my windows, too.
I'm actually currently suspended in those chains from, I believe, Saw 4, the rib ripper, because I'm so afraid of my lungs collapsing that they're ready to uncollapse them at any moment, so.
They're just going to go the opposite direction, I feel like. Can you get, reverse lung collapsism? Is that a
thing? A lung explosion?
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe, if it,
That's actually what happens if you kiss before marriage. They blow into your mouth so hard your lungs explode.
Ooh.
That's true. That's a thing.
Yeah, that's what my teacher taught me.
So I want to touch on, this week for the Gamer Safety Update, something that you might have all experienced. I currently live in the middle of nowhere, but I used to live in a town, like normal people. And I don't know if you've all ever experienced this, but I hope you have. Someone stealing your Wi-Fi.
I thought, for a second there, my brain completed his wife, and I was like, never on the receiving end.
Does Sasquatch ever wander out of the woods and steal your wife?
your wife and your Wi-Fi. All the time. That's actually the plot of Willow Creek, the Bobcat Goldthwait found footage Bigfoot movie.
Oh yeah, it is.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, back to the topic at hand. Stealing your Wi-Fi. How are we going to protect ourselves from this? Are we finally sponsored? Is this a NordVPN commercial? Did you get a
NordVPN commercial?
I thought we were in the big leagues now.
Shit.
What up, Nord? We're out here. Jamathan, in Germany, is stealing Wi-Fi a crime?
Oh, God. I don't know. I don't think it is, because, the only time I would imagine someone being able to steal your Wi-Fi is if it's not password protected, right?
Right, yeah.
Well, people hack it, right? They can hack Wi-Fi or something. I don't really know how that works. Is hacking Wi-Fi a thing?
I don't think you have to, because from what I know, the government even encourages having public Wi-Fi in, restaurants and stuff, which is kind of the worst idea, but I don't know. So if you don't even have to steal Wi-Fi, you just go to a place like that and you get free Wi-Fi, basically.
I can imagine that, you can either... I don't know how the internet works, so tell me if I'm being an idiot. But can you, plug into their cable thing? Can you install a splitter on the outside where the internet goes into their building and surreptitiously steal their Wi-Fi that way? That'd be the only way I can think of, other than, taking a picture of their router and, copying the password.
So that's kind of a more of an old school thing with cable boxes. Whenever people still had cable boxes, they used to make a thing called an ether killer. Is anybody familiar with an ether killer?
Is that when you just have a lot of cocaine and it just ruins your ether high?
No, there's a ether killer, Atari killer, Sega killer. And they're named that because they're made out of RF adapters for Segas and Ataris. If you take
any 70-year-old drug addict that was high in Vegas before they invented video games, just really liked that joke, by the way. So.
No, you make them out of those adapters, the Sega Killer.
Well, and who's done ether in like 30 years, right?
Right. I'm definitely not huffing raw ether over here.
People still do Ethernet, actually, around here.
No, ether, like the drug. See, you're so young, you don't know what I'm talking about.
Okay, I thought we were talking about Ethernet. I heard ether, and I was like, it's commonly Ethernet. Referenced. People still do Ethernet. Yes,
it's commonly referenced in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is also where Hunter Thompson made up Adrenochrome. So the whole thing about the Q babies, you know, getting harvested for their Adrenochrome, it's all made up. Just in case you didn't know, in case you were curious about whether QAnon was made up or not.
Well, it turns out I learned something new every day, I suppose.
Learning all sorts of stuff. But whenever people, they used to be able to plug into your, they go out to your cable box and split it off and steal your cable. That was like a thing in the 90s and early 2000s. So you could make an Ether Killer, a Sega Killer, or an Atari Killer, plug that in, and it would reverse the electricity and fry anything they turned on, like in their house.
That's pretty baller, yeah. So do they have that now for Wi-Fi or something?
No, not so much. But
you know what you can do is like unplug the actual cords that you know connect to fiber or whatever weird shit you got going on. I don't exactly know how it works, but I do know. Did you guys know that there's like little like feuds between, obviously because they're competition, right? But did you know there's little feuds between cable companies and shit? And like, you know, like for example, around here, you can either get Comcast or CenturyLink, and like they will actually go Comcast or CenturyLink. They'll go and unplug like CenturyLink's cables or like vice versa. And then like people will be like, my internet's out. And it's like, oh, well, that's because Comcast unplugged our thing or like CenturyLink unplugged our thing. And it's like this like little like indirect bickering between cords. It's quite interesting, actually.
You're gonna get me to go off on a socialism rant again. This is why we need socialism. This is why back when in the early days of fire stations, when fire stations used to be privately owned by different companies. That's actually how who the fuck's that Roman guy that got really rich? The guy that was super rich that everyone remembers for being very rich. He owned. Crassus, there we go. Mercedes Crassus. His thing was that he owned the fire stations. And basically, whenever anyone's house is on fire, he'd show up with a bunch of water and be like, hey, I got these elephants that shoot water out of their nose. It's a really funny thing about that. Do you have, like, money? And then, like, and that's how he got really rich. And it used to be that fire stations, you can actually see this in the movie Gangs of New York with Leonardo DiCaprio and Daniel Day-Lewis. They represent one of these fire station brawls, is that like these fire stations were privately owned and they there was like no oversight. So like fire sometimes they'd like show up to a burning down house and the firefighters would just like fight each other because they're like, you're in our territory. Like, wow, the house burned down. It was like horrible. And so like the way that they fixed that was that they made like firefighting a public service. And so now you don't have to like compete. But like the fact that people are like, oh, we should go back to the days like, oh, it should be privatized. That's better. Like that was privatized. Like you would just have people punching each other while houses burned down. Like that's a fucking idiotic. Anyways, sorry, not to go up on a, Ted's doing a socialism rant. I'm sorry.
Jans, what is our gamer safety update?
No, I wanted to get into like a little joke. I was going to say, welcome to the fire station, Mr. Chapo. So the gamer safety update, and it's not what you think. I don't know if you ever see those videos where the guy's like, it's not what you think. I don't know. That joke might have fallen flat. Who cares? Anyway, we are going to Messange, France. In Messange, France, a cellular phone company noticed that between the hours of midnight and 3 a.m., the entire town of Messange, France didn't have internet. The signal mysteriously dropped completely. The cell phone companies were investigating. The internet companies were investigating. No one could figure out what the problem was. Between midnight and 3 a.m., no internet. Anywhere. No cell phone, no internet, no contact to the outside world. The town goes black for 3 hours a night. So one intrepid investigator decided to walk the streets of Messange with his portable analytics equipment. And as soon as the clock hit midnight, everything dropped out. And he's like, that is so weird. So he started tracking where the source of this outage was coming from. And can we guess where it was?
But. In his butt. Was it in his butt?
It was not
ghosts.
His butt.
It was probably ghosts.
They discovered that it was one man who had bought a weird bootleg signal jammer from Amazon to keep his kids from sneaking onto the internet at night. And he was inadvertently shutting off the entire cellular and internet network to an entire town. He was quite literally...
fucking funny. Oh, man.
What's that, Jamathan?
Can't you just turn off the Wi-Fi router for the night?
Yeah, I don't know what...
Maybe he wanted to use it at night, though.
So he said the issue was...
a pretty good point. Like, if the kid wants to go to bed, but you still want to play World of Warcraft, you know? Like,
yeah,
but
if you've got the jammer installed, you're not going to have any signal either, so it's...
Or something easier, take the devices, you know, like, I don't know, it's that simple, just get the devices and,
Abby, parenting is really hard. It's way easier to just not talk to your kids.
Oh, perfect. So, yeah, just pretend they're not there.
Yeah, exactly.
Authorities spoke with this man, and they said, hey, did you know you're shutting off, like, thousands of people's everything every night? And he went, my kids got addicted to the TikTok after COVID, and I have to get them off the internet at night. And they were sneaking onto the internet between midnight and 3 a.m. I thought this just worked for my house. And they're like, no, you're killing an entire city every night from midnight to 3.
So this dude was just like EMPing a town every night and like wasn't aware.
Yeah, like, it's so weird. And also, something that would block signals that powerfully, you just have it on your coffee table, is there... I don't know, I'm not Bill Nye the Science Guy, but wouldn't that maybe create, like, is this guy gonna die of super cancer in, like, a year?
I just, like, I remember, like, have any of y'all ever played, like, Stalker? And, like, sometimes you can go to, like, a merchant and buy, like, a super powerful artifact that's, like, you know, radiated. And, like, it's, like, does he just keep that on his shelf? Like, is he just hanging out next to it all day? So it's, like, wow, 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 like, next to him.
He's, like, oh, man, this thing makes a weird noise whenever you turn it on at night.
No, no, no. At least it, like, you know, lights up the room. It's a nice little nightlight with that radiation.
So, as well-intentioned as he may have been, he is facing possible jail time and fines for disrupting... cellular service in that area.
This is actually like super, super interesting because like the question of like who gets to disrupt different services is like it's tied really heavily into the question of like public utility. So like I don't know if you know this, but there's this little organization called the FCC, which is like the federal. Jonathan, it's in like the United States. It's like the organizing body that like kind of regulates media. It's basically like obscenity law and things like that. But you know, and it's really slow to catch up because you know there's all these like how the laws that we have on the books, right, for like managing communication are like designed for like films and television. Like, how does one regulate TikTok or Twitter? You know, like it's like and to be fair, like those are where people get their information more nowadays than on the radio. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a weird situation. Yeah, it's a weird situation.
But when they started regulating it, it actually came out of regulating the radio. So basically, there was this organizing body before the FCC called the FRC, which was the Federal Radio Commission. And the reason that it started is because they were like, okay, there's only so many like, as opposed to the, I guess there's like a limited amount of internet technically, but like there's a far more limited amount of radio waves because there's only like so many frequencies you can be on. Like it's like AM and FM waves, like you can't have two on the same station. So there's like there's a set finite amount. So like, well, we need to preserve this national resource because like otherwise the radio waves will get too full and like we won't have enough radio. But the reason this all kind of started is because of before radio was widely adopted as a method of like news and stuff, it was originally just like a hobbyist thing. Like basically like dudes with a drone now were dudes with radios back then. They just like, I just think it's neat. I get on my radio and I talk to other people. It was like early days of, you know, in the back when they had like the PlayStation Live and stuff where you could just like random channels and just like, you didn't know if you were going to get like someone's like cooking show or an old dude dressed up like Santa jerking off. You're like, you just had no fucking idea what you'd get. It was like Omegle. There we go. That was like the original radio was like Omegle. or yeah, exactly. It was like old school Chatterbait. There you go. Now you can imagine like 1950s dudes being like, or 1920s dudes being like, "What are you wearing over there, honey?"
I'm getting all jerking off. Getting all horned up over here. More news coming soon.
All horned up, second by second. But what happened is that like kids would get on these things at like their parents' radio stations, and they'd call in like prank calls to the Navy. And they'd be like, "Oh yeah, like my ship's going down. It's like the ship in my toilet. It's made of poop." And then they'd like hang up. And the Navy was like, "We get calls like this every day," and they couldn't differentiate. And then like there was an accident like that happened, and like they called in. They're like, "Help us, help us!" And like the guy's name was like something silly, like Icy Wieners, like, and not like really, but like, you know, it was like something along those lines. And they just like didn't believe him, and a bunch of people died. And they're like, "Okay, we need to get these kids off these radios." A bunch of people just died.
Quick follow-up joke. I was going to say, what was I going to say? Oh, Japan declares war on my boner, and then he just hangs up, like, the radio. Oh, good times. So, the agency that was investigating the cellular drop put out a oddly ominous statement. They said, "By wanting to ban the internet in his home, he applied the same sentence to his entire neighborhood." That's some real Twilight Zone shit.
Yeah, fucking wrote that headline. It's like really shooting for their career. Yeah, they're trying to replace Rod Sterling. You know, it's like some real fucking energy.
And then I would have made this its own gamer safety update, but I'm going to tie it into this one because it's kind of the same thing. In 2020, telecoms engineers spent 18 months trying to figure out why the internet went out at 7 a.m. every morning in this small village, a small Welsh village. And it turned out that a guy was turning on his old ass TV for the news at 7, and the TV was so old it was sending out electric bursts that were disrupting the entire village's internet.
It was like, imagine this old man sitting there being irradiated by like light, like the fucking TV for Poltergeist. They're just like wisps coming out of it. He's like, "Oh, this is normal."
I just imagine the camera, like they're like, "Who's doing this?" And the camera pans over a group of people, and like in the middle, there's one old guy that's faintly glowing, and he's like, "Yeah, who could have done this?"
He's just like live streaming like the hell dimension from like Hellraiser. It's like sending out like waves, like disruption waves across the world. Like the electricity's coming out of it, like when they summon the Cenobites, you know, makes all the lights explode in the original Hellraisers, not so much in the newer ones.
Your gamer safety update is don't buy janky jammers off of the old Amazon.
Or do, fuck it. I mean, we're not suggesting that people do, but like we can't tell you not to.
Yeah, we can't legally stop you. We can ask you not to.
We're not condoning it, but we're also mentioning that we can't stop you from using this information.
That's actually the show's new tagline: not condoning but not condemning. Real professional.
What happens to a crypto farm if it gets like knocked out of Wi-Fi? Like, can it still function? Like, does the processing power do anything? Does it turn off, or does it just sit there turned on, just not connected to anything?
It goes off like one of the old one-armed bandit slot machines. Like, all the bitcoins pour out of it into a bucket on the floor.
Oh yeah, that's how you harvest physical bitcoins. Is you have to wait for the servers to cool down, and then you can go in and mine them.
Get in here with your buckets. So, Jamathan.
Yes,
I am going to tell the listeners out there. You are. This is your first podcast appearance, right?
That's right.
How? You're making cool stuff. No one was like, "Hey, come talk to us about your cool stuff."
No, not really.
No, I was hoping that you were going to be like, "Oh, I turned them all down because I was waiting for the king of podcasts, real professional."
Yeah, I've been like 100 requests already. Like the first hour after launch or something. No, not really. I don't know. The only thing I've done before was on the Holopius 1 YouTube channel. Actually, no, I think we live streamed on Twitch as well. We did like a playthrough of the demo disc games with Aiden Cushing.
For 2021 or 2020?
2021, yeah.
Okay, cool.
And yeah, I appeared on that. I don't think it was ever... I don't think the VOD was published. They've only published like a few VODs. I don't know.
Because that was the Highwald loophole. The first demo was on the Haunted PS1 demo disc 2021, right? Not 2020?
Yeah, it was in 2021.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Because I was trying to remember, like, because The first demo disc, like, is where, like, I found, like, Dread Delusion. Or is that 2019? Shit. How many are there now? I think there's only two, right?
There's only two. Yeah, the first one was in 2020.
Yeah, exactly.
Was Dread Delusion on the first one?
It was, yes. That's that's how I discovered it, is off the first demo disc, and that's when I reached out to Lovely Hellplace about it, and, you know, right. That's when we got him on for the first collection, and now we're, you know, publishing Dread Delusion, so.
Yeah.
So, the Howl Loophole, I played it. It was the first demo I played on the 2021 demo disc. And it managed to startle me, which I don't... It doesn't happen often. I'm trying to think of, like, the list of games that actually, like, got a jump out of me, because I played almost exclusively horror games. So it's kind of hard. You know, I'm not trying to say, like... I'm not trying to puff myself up here and be like, I'm not afraid of anything. But, that super distorted voice from the doctor scared me. It caught me by surprise because it was very loud. I think it's you and Paranoia Hell by Lum also got me really good. That was not a demo disc. I just played the game. It's a very... I've got to sit down with the full version of the Heilwald Loophole, and it is a very German game.
I think that's a good way to describe it.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a good way to put it, Jans, for sure.
Well, like, I agree. Like, Ted and Abby know, like, most of my friends online and such are German. I hang out with a group of Germans. And I've told them to check out the Howl Loophole. I'm like, it's made by a fellow German, and I think that you would really enjoy it. And it is, it's horror, but from that, like, culturally workman-like stance of Germany, if that makes sense.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think the most German thing about it is probably the fact that you're getting yelled at a lot. At least that's what I've been told. I've not really thought about that while making it, but in retrospective, that's very true, yeah. Not to say that this is the general experience that you will get in Germany, but it's certainly... a part of it.
You heard it from a fellow German, friends. If you've never been to Germany, this is what you can expect. You just get yelled at all the time.
It's a real fun time, yeah. Can't recommend it enough.
So, your other projects, like Insomnia. Insomnia. What was it about the Howl Loophole that you're like, I need to make this into a full experience?
That's a good question, probably, because I don't know, I had a lot of ideas for it. So the thing with Insomnia was, like, it never really went anywhere. It was just, like, a small collection of, like, simplified dreams that I had. And I wanted to add, like, a lot more. I still kind of want to do that, because I think my dreams are very strange and really fucked up at times. So they're definitely worth turning into, like, a game or experience or whatever, but I don't know. I don't know why I want to turn it into a full game. Yeah, probably just because I had, like, the ideas for it, and the reception was generally better, I think.
Well, I actually have a question about, like, your design philosophy, because, you know, it's an interesting game because, you know, you have these different paths that you kind of have to follow, right? Like, and mm-hmm. It's not necessarily presented in, like, the most linear fashion, the game, you know, like, there's kind of different routes that you take in order to, like, get to the final goal. Yeah. And that is, like, a very, like, the design philosophy isn't even, like, retro in the sense of, like, Resident Evil. It's retro in the sense of, like, Sierra adventure games. And I don't know, like, what was your inspiration for that style? Like, why did you decide that was, like, the way that you wanted to present this world and have players go through it?
Oh god, that's another really good question that I'm not sure if that... Oh god, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of the devs in that kind of community, the haunted PS1 community and stuff, like, especially indie devs, the zeitgeist nowadays, is very, like, often directed. It's like, there's like a purposeful design. Like, it used to be the case that it was like, you know, a lot of people that are making games are just like, okay, what's popular? Let's try to jump on that train. But now, like, the prevailing indie development sentiment is, like, kind of the opposite of that. Like, it's kind of, it's, what I would say is, like, it's popular iconoclasm, which is, like, rather than having, being alone and being, like, the sole person fighting against the system, there's these, like, pockets of people that are like, no, I want to develop games this way. I think Haunted PS1 is one of those groups where it's like, you know, there's like, an ethos to it beyond the PS1 aesthetic. You get what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I think that, you know, the question is like, when designing a game, like, the Highwall Loophole, like, the way that you choose to design the game is, like, it's revealing of, like, what kind of games you like to play or to make. And so, like, what would you say that, like, the Highwall Loophole's design philosophy says about your personal, like, tastes?
I gotta be honest. When I made the whole thing, I didn't really think about how I wanted to design it in that sense. I think I just kind of went with the flow. So, like, the whole idea of the scenario and of, like, the interaction with the characters actually also came from a dream, which I think is kind of, like, a fun fact that not a lot of people know. It's just, I wanted the whole thing to feel like, I don't know, that's the wrong way to phrase it, I'm sorry.
I mean, no, that makes sense, because, like, the movement is very, like, when you turn left and right, it's very, like, floaty. Like, I wouldn't say floaty, but it is, there's that weightlessness to it. And also, like, the voices are very, like, very dream logic distorted. Like, it doesn't feel like someone's turning into a monster. It sounds like the kinds of voice that when someone, like, yells at you in a dream and it, like, startles you and it doesn't sound correct, you know?
Yeah. Well, the goal of the whole thing is not necessarily to feel like a dream. Like, that's definitely not the focus of it, right? It's never really implied that this whole thing is a dream, because I think that's kind of, like, a very cliche thing to do at this point. You know, you have, like, this whole crazy game with this.
Oh, it's my, like, least favorite plot twist. Yeah, I fucking hate it when all the games end with, like, oh, it was all in their head the whole time. It's like, great, yeah. Well, nothing happened.
Wait. Isn't that the entire basis for Sucker for Love, Ted?
That's all in his head. No, I'm like, okay, it was all Eldritch Gods.
It was, but all, yeah, a dream.
Okay, that, ha 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 ha.
Got him. Ha! I'm out of here, guys. I'll see you later.
Anyways, yeah. Sorry. What were you saying, Jonathan?
Yeah. Well, as I said, it's like, it's the main goal is not for the thing to feel like a dream. It's, I don't know. It's a good question. So this is, I don't know. This might sound a bit dumb, but it's like, I didn't really have, like, a goal to, or like a thing to convey with the game. It's just kind of, I wanted to be like a small experience that you can go through, right? And that maybe conveys a bit, or not conveys, but, like, I don't know. It communicates a bit about, like, I don't know, my mindset when it comes to hospitals or something. I don't know. So it's a bit hard to explain, honestly.
No, I mean, I understand. Like, it can often, the thing about horror is that, like, it's very, like, emotive genre, right? Like, it's like, you, like, when you're playing, it either hits or it doesn't. Like, there's nothing you can do to, like, fake that. Like, you can't make up for horror without, like, if it's not scary. So, like, what kind of scares were you going for? Like, what kind of scares do you personally like in your games?
That's a good question. So maybe I should start with that dream thing that I said before. That, so, like, the whole thing kind of originated from a dream. I think the feeling I wanted in this game was to be kind of trapped in, like, a claustrophobic environment, and there is someone who may or may not want to hurt you, who's, like, constantly following you or something. That was kind of the scenario in the dream, where I was basically in, like, a weird hospital back room kind of thing. Not the back rooms, me, just, like, a back room of a hospital, right? And there were, like, a bunch of syringes, and there were nurses around who were not very nice to me, I guess. And the end goal was kind of to just, you know, grab a syringe and then get rid of those nurses with the syringe. And that's how the whole first section of the game with Dr. Randolph kind of originated. And the rest kind of, I don't know, the rest didn't really have anything to do with dreams. I think there was just kind of, like, I thought of cool environments that I wanted to have in the hospital that I, mm-hmm. I thought would be cool to explore from like a level design perspective or from environmental design perspective, and then also like gameplay perspective, like what kind of gimmicks could you have? Because I wanted to break loose from this like standard survival horror game thing where you just, you know, you're being chased by something and then you complete the chase section and that's basically it.
Right.
So I wanted to have a bit more interaction with the characters themselves, which mm-hmm. I mean is kind of the case for most of the characters where you're not instantly getting chased by them, right? They're kind of, they might seem friendly in quotation marks at first, and then depending on what you do, it just they might be pissed off, and then the whole thing starts.
Yeah, it's interactable in ways other than like it's just chasing you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
The real question is though, like, do you ever just drift off into sleep and then all of a sudden in the back of your head you just hear, "Where are you going?" And then you're like, "Oh shit. Shit, it's here. It's happening. It's in real life now." And then you're like, "Ah, nah, man. That's just in my head."
I'm very glad I don't. I think we'll be kind of...
Maybe that's just me. Okay. Anyway.
I really like your approach to that because I am a huge opponent of hide and seek horror, as I call it. I mean, there is a place for it for sure. You know, the hide in lockers is the entire gameplay loop horror. And I really liked what the Hollowall loophole did with that. Like, there is some of that, but it's in service of a larger thing. And I really appreciate what you did with that. But just a quick follow-up. What scares you, Jamathan? What scares you?
Oh. That's honestly, I don't think about that a lot because... Okay, maybe in the context of like other horror games, I feel like, and that's kind of sad, honestly, I feel like I'm at a point where if I play a horror game, it's just not really scary anymore, which I don't know. I think I'm just kind of like, I've played so much stuff in the past that it doesn't really faze me anymore. Like, I remember playing Amnesia for the first time, and the Dark Descent, the very first one. And I think that was also my first horror game. And that kind of, it did freak me out a bit. Or like a bit, it freaked me out a lot, let's be honest. But at this point, I don't really know anymore.
It kind of seems like your stuff has more of a quality of creeping dread than outright horror. Like the first game of yours that I ever played was a couple years ago. I played The Backrooms. Which was, I haven't researched it and I'm not going to, but I think that you were probably one of the first people to hit on making a game out of the concept of the Backrooms. Oh, go ahead.
So, I don't think I was the first person. There was definitely one before that. That was like very simple. That was, it was adhering to the style of this like classic Backrooms image a lot more than I did. And I just kind of wanted to have like a spin on it. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that game was like centered around creeping dread for sure. Like, it didn't really have, that was the whole idea behind it. Like, I just wanted to try to make something that didn't have any enemies at all. Like, I posted some images on Twitter that had like shadowy figures in the distance that you could see. So like, people would even think there may be enemies in the game, but in the end there weren't, like until the very end, which I wouldn't really consider an enemy. And apparently it was really effective. And that was like the moment when I realized, okay, you don't actually need any real threat at all. You just need good sound design, basically, to get something to feel very, very unsettling. And I've noticed that myself a couple of times. Maybe I think a very good example of that is, oh yeah, to circle back to the question about what scares me. I watched the movie Annihilation like a couple of months back. Not sure if you're familiar with that one. With like the
that's one of my favorite movies.
Oh, all right. Well, that's really good because that was, I think, one of the movies. I don't watch a lot of movies, but this was like one of the movies that actually like really, really freaked me out. Like, especially this. I don't know if I can spoil this right here. but I kind of have to.
You can spoil whatever you want. Who cares?
Okay. Well, so there's like in the middle of the movie, there's this scene with the where they're like in this house, and one of the women like ties the arrows to the chairs or something. And then this bear creature comes in mm-hmm. and like speaks with this imitated voice of like the person it's consumed before, and that was like one of the freakiest moments I've ever experienced in the movie, just because the sound design was so good. Like it just sounded like a creature that was trying to imitate a human voice, and it just didn't I don't know, how do I say this, like it wasn't quite there. It's basically just the uncanny valley, but in like a sound kind of way, right?
Yeah, I think that like sound design is one of the most important part of developing horrors for sure.
Yeah.
Yes, 100%.
But I think that it's kind of a nice thing whenever horror developers start to get kind of jaded by outright horror, because it kind of... Wow, I didn't silence my phone for like the third podcast in a row. But once you get jaded by horror, devs seem to either double down and go hard on jump scares, thinking, you know, this has got to be scary, or they go the creeping dread route. And I like that route because it brings forth a more subtle horror, and I appreciate a subtle horror. That's why I enjoyed the back rooms so much, because there are no enemies in the back rooms. There's just the idea of enemies in your brain, because you're playing a horror game and you're like, they're going to show up eventually. But like you said, other than the end, which is not really an enemy, you can wander these back rooms, and it's just simple sounds. Really good sound design in that, by the by, that we were just talking about. But yeah, and it just fudges with that part of your brain that you're constantly expecting something around every corner. So you're hyping yourself up. You as the developer, you know, you don't have to do work, as much work, but at the same time, you're doing all the work, letting the player build up a scare in their head that's never going to come. And it doesn't feel unsatisfying whenever there's not a scare. It's just like you finish it and you're like, oh damn, there wasn't anything. Like, can't believe I got myself so psyched up about this.
Yeah, I think this is probably the best way I can answer the question about what scares me. I think it's literally just the sound. I don't think like imagery phases me anymore. Like, I mean, of course there's probably something out there is still like would freak me out, but I think the worst part is definitely the sound, or even just thinking about what a certain let's say a certain portrayed scene would sound like. That's even worse. I just really like to work with these kind of things, and honestly, like while developing stuff, I don't even really notice how scary this like something might be to other people, because I personally don't think the Hyrule Loop is particularly scary, like at least to me, but apparently to other people it really is, which is good, I think. So
yeah. I definitely agree on that part. Like, sound makes everything for me in a horror game. I would say the two things that I actually am like, and I'm really kind of person that like when I get freaked out, I'm like, oh, that's great, like that's really cute. And I get really excited about it. But it's like sounds in animations, I would say, like really weird, wacky, abnormal animations really are just, they really get to me. And I just, going back to sound though for a moment there, I just think that there are so many games that could be way scarier that I've played if they just had like super strong sound design. And that's what I, especially because, you know, as you know, or at least probably know, we're working on the fifth collection, and this is something that I say to the developers that we're working with, is like, you know, like go crazy with that sound design, because it's in like the creepy shit. People get a really big kick out of that. And especially, it's not just games though, too. You know, we were just talking about movies as well. A movie that does that for me is Sinister. I feel like the sounds in Sinister, like especially during like each film, is what made those films like kind of creepy. I feel like the sound design was just so good. It's something that I haven't been able to get over since I saw it in theaters so many years ago now, but it's one of those movies that I remember specifically for its sound design, and like without that sound design, I don't think that movie would be as good.
Which film?
Sinister.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I feel like Jamathan and Abby both, you're hitting on kind of the evolution of horror game dev that we're seeing right now. And it's kind of small at the moment, but I feel like it's picking up steam, and it's developers who make their first game and they go, I'm going to put a jump scare. Something's going to jump at your face, which is fine. Everybody's got to start somewhere and start with your jump scare because it's the strongest thing. It's going to scare the kiddos and the easily frightened. But then whenever you start to kind of dig into the science of horror, you start to focus less on the visual side of it and more on the sound side of it.
Yes.
And I think we're seeing that a lot more in horror games. I mean, look at MFN, you know, the game that we're publishing, My Friendly Neighborhood. A lot of the comments, the demo came out recently, and a lot of the comments I'm seeing aren't like, oh, these puppets are so scary. I mean, there's plenty of comments that are like, the puppets are scary. But there's a not insignificant amount of comments saying the sound design is superb. You know, there's something creepy about walking down a hallway and you can hear a Muppet voice, which is not like a puppet. It's not scary on its own, but you add that bit of echo, that little bit of reverb, you know, the sound of a dripping pipe.
Exactly.
And in the distance, you just hear like that, hey, 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 hey. And you're like, oh, what the fuck is that? And
exactly.
I feel like that's the next evolution in horror game dev is this big focus on sound. And I love to see it because nothing evokes fear quite like sound. Because we, as humans, we have really good like directional hearing. Not as good as like a cat. But we use sounds to sense danger more than our sense of sight. Comparatively with other animals, we have terrible sight. You know, there's colors we don't even see compared to some animals, but our sense of hearing is very good. So that's our first way to sense danger. And I think leaning into that going forward is going to be the way to be for most devs.
I think that I don't even think it's a new thing. Like, I think that sound design for a long time has been the great equalizer, because like you can have really, really, really good sound design for far cheaper than you can have really good graphics.
It's been a thing, but I feel like devs aren't leaning into it or weren't leaning into it as hard as they are now. It was something that seemed reserved for AAA, and then people are realizing, like you were saying, it's far cheaper to just have excellent sound design.
I think it also takes a little more talent, right? Like anyone can code in or blueprint in, you know, a jump scare. I think that sound design takes a little more thought and it takes a little more talent. Not that people who don't utilize like really great sound design as like they're not talented, of course. It's just that not only do we all have different perspectives on horror, but I think that sounds tend to get brushed under the rug a little bit when making a game, especially when considering timelines and stuff like that. And, you know, you actually don't really truly know the power of sound until you put out a game and you're like, people are really scared. But why, though? And Jan, so you were talking about like walking down a hallway and hearing a sound. This is something that I have direct experience with, you know. When we released Theater Unrest, people were really scared by that game. And I was kind of thinking, like, I mean, yeah, I can see why it's scary, but there were some people that were really scared shitless by that game. And it does that exact same thing where you're going through that loop of walking down a theater hallway to go to various films, and there you never know what's going to happen, but the sounds are really leading you to different places. And you know, a lot of people were into that and a lot of people got scared by it. And that was, I think, my first direct experience with, like, at least from a developer's standpoint of like seeing how sound really affects people.
Yeah, I mean, when I was designing the fourth collection, for those of you out there that don't know, like, I write the stories and do the level design and like the overall design of the collection's launchers. And when I write the script out and I write the level design out and like write the objectives and the pathing out, I have the soundtrack in mind when I'm doing it. Like, okay, this is where I want this to kick in. This is where I want these beats to like hit the emotional drive. And it's like night and day between when you have like a good sound design and not. And like the actual, it takes more planning and it takes more like, but it's one of those things that like I think that once you start working it into your planning, it can really, really like up the quality of your narrative by a lot.
I mean, look at PT. PT is probably one of the scariest things I've ever played. And it's
still,
yeah, still to the, you know, it's been a long time since I should play it. I still have it on my PS4. There was just, and it's all sound. I mean, there is the Lisa jump scare, whatever. That's fine. It's just the walking down that hallway, the crunchy audio on the radio, the skittering of bugs, it's simple, small sound cues that do a lot for that game. But so I guess the whole point here is whenever a game says headphones recommended, maybe put on your fucking headphones.
I just kind of want to name another few like examples. I think what like sound design that really struck me is in actually the Resident Evil games, like the latest one, like 8, 7 as well. I can't comment on the ones that are in between because I haven't played those yet. But those have really good like environmental sound design. In terms of like, you know, like a leaking pipe or like, I don't know, some kind of like crunching in the background. And they do it to an extent where actually, like, I sometimes can't tell if this sound's in my room or if it's in the game, like it's that good. And I think this is like, that's kind of peak sound design for me, or like implementation of the sound or integration of the sound into the environment.
Yeah.
That's something
like the titular village in Resident Evil Village in Resident Evil 8 is the sound design there, the soundscape that they've created is amazing. Like you get all of those kind of snow sounds, like water dripping off a roof onto more snow, onto metal, the crunch of the footsteps, the things moving in the distance, fabric fluttering in a window. They really created something amazing with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I think it's interesting though, because like, I was thinking, I often think about this, like what it is about horror that sticks with people over the longer periods of time. And I think that like sound design, like good sound design is one of those things that like will stick with people far after other things. Like, for example, Silent Hill, right? Like Silent Hill would not be Silent Hill without like the soundtrack, the original soundtrack and the sound design, you know, the crackling of the static on the radio when the monsters come close, all that stuff. Like it just fits together all so fucking well to the point where it's like, you know, that Akira Yamaoka soundtrack. It's like, can you even imagine it, Silent Hill, the original, without that? Like, it's so integral to the personality. And that's the thing, though, is that has outlasted the graphic. Like, I always hate to say this because it'll get me, like, yelled at online by the horror community, but, like, young people nowadays, like, younger people, don't play Silent Hill. Like, they don't play the original Silent Hill. They don't play Resident Evil. Like, the generation of people that played those games is, like, getting older. And we are, like, you know, the adults now, and we're basically making a games for like a shrinking community of other adults that are still into horror games. And yeah, sure, every once in a while some kid will come in, but like overall the average kid is going to play, you know, a new horror game, like, you know, the new Five Nights at Freddy's over the original Silent Hill. And one of the big reasons for that is because, you know, Silent Hill hasn't come out with new content in 25 years, because of course the series stopped after 4 and nothing else happened after that. And you know, and so, you know, because they haven't come out with anything in so long, you know, the modern youth does not have the same affinity to Silent Hill that we do. But you can still put on that soundtrack and, you know, have those same, if you put that same soundtrack, those same sounds, that same sound design, exact same in a game today, it would still slap. Like graphics, no. Gameplay, I mean, I think some people still like that gameplay, but I think there's a lot of like improvements that have happened over that original gameplay that like, you know, have obviously, you know, and just like inventory management, stuff like that. And there's a lot of people that enjoy the retro, but what I'm talking about is like mass market appeal. But that soundtrack, like I said, any day you could put it in. And I think that's kind of like, in my opinion, kind of the heart of indie. And I think that, you know, I know that Silent Hill is weird to think about as indie, but like the original Silent Hill was made by like 5 guys. And, you know, basically 5 guys trying their best to do something interesting, unique, and different. And I think that that is the heart and soul of indie, is like, you know, we can't punch at the levels of, you know, Call of Duty, right? Like if we needed to make, or even like, you know, let me just choose another horror contemporary, like Resident Evil or like Bloober Team or something like that. Like, you know, even at Dread XP where we have, you know, some money, like we can't match that level. Like we just don't have the funds. And but we can try to punch at like a different in a different arena. And to me, that's like the core of like indie horror is like there's all the other people doing the mainstream things, the things that everyone is talking about, you know, the things that are really, really cool and popular. And of course, there's a bunch of like indie people that are going to like try to copy that. But to me, the zeitgeist of indie at the moment is and I just use that word because we have a German guest. So you're welcome, Jonathan. I'm thinking of you. Nice. Thank you. But it's like it's to do the counterculture thing. You know, it's to try something different. And that's the thing is like for every indie hit that is out there, there are 1,000 to 2,000 games that come out that no one fucking plays. And, and you know, the torture of being an indie creator is like creating something cool. Something you put like years of your life into, something that's really unique and different. And then it comes out on Steam and you get like 1,000 sales and you're like, well, that was my fucking life. And that's the thing that's heartbreaking is because like you see the hits, you see the Bastions, you see the Five Nights at Freddy's, you see the Devourers, you see the Phasmophobias, you don't see the 2,000 equally good and possibly even better executed ideas, because it's just not, it's like rolling dice every time. Are you hitting it the exact right moment for this? So that's why I always like whenever I'm talking to like a new developer, I talk about like try to make something that is the best version of what you want to make, because it's such a fucking dice roll that like you can make something that you think is going to hit the market really well and it just fucking won't. And like, you know, and that happens to me too, you know, like I predict that sales in some of our games are going to be higher than others. And you know, sometimes I'm wrong and like, and that's kind of, you know, why I started the collections in general. I'm sorry, I'm ranting again. I fucking always do this, but like when I started the collections, it was like so that people could have a place to try those small ideas on a short term and not like ruin their fucking lives doing it. And like 2 years of development to get nothing out of it. And you know, and I think that gives people a really cool opportunity to experiment. And that's why I like playing games like the Highwalled Loophole, Jonathan. Like it's a game that like I will say that like Highwalled Loophole is not particularly my style of game. I don't much like the running away from enemies style of horror games that kind of exist nowadays. I liked the interactivity with it, like in the beginning and figuring out kind of how to beat each of the monsters. And I loved kind of like the way you would go back to previous sections and like, you know, kind of that kind of checkpointing system. I really liked it. I liked the, like the prison that you kind of go into in the end, like really evocative environments. And that's the thing is that like, to me, if you're making an indie horror game with the intention that like this is going to really blow up, unless you're like Choo Choo Charles by Two Star Games is being currently developed. Like basically Gavin has figured out what works really well. And he said this when he was with us on the podcast, like I'm not like trashing him or anything, but like he was saying that like he basically has designed the game to be like something that would blow up on YouTube. Yeah. And right. And so like you can do that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, okay, well, what is your comprehensive design here? Like, what is this going to look like in the long term? And are you going to like making this game? Because at the end of the day, if you're going to be spending, you know, a year or 2 years making one fucking game, you better like making it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, so, yeah, that's what I wanted to say is that, like, I think that games like yours, like the Highwalled Loophole, are... they are inherently, by nature of their existence, a reflection of the counterculture. Like, even if you're not actively trying to make it counterculture, the reality is that economically, we as indies cannot compete with AAA. And as such, we create things in the side spaces where we have space to roam and actually kind of find our own success. And as such, the games that we choose to make are inherently a reflection of that, more so than, you know, Ubisoft deciding to try to shoehorn in some diversity despite it just being the same, you know, shooter espousing the same fucking values that Ubisoft has been promoting for, you know, 20 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sorry, did that all make sense? I know I went on for a minute.
No, yeah, I think like a really big part of indie games at this point is also like what you touched on as well, like the like making a game that's specifically designed to blow up on YouTube or Twitch or whatever. I think like a really good example of that in like recent time would be Poppy Playtime, which was like, yes, when that, I don't know, when that hit, like it was all over YouTube, was probably Twitch as well, and I'm not really active on there. It was like insane. I mean, we all know what kind of happened to that game at this point. But this is, I don't know, it just feels like this happens more and more often. And I don't know, not really the biggest fan of it, but I can understand why people do it, because I mean, this is kind of, if you design a game that's like made for, unless let's say like a younger audience, which I mean, Poppy Playtime kind of is, I suppose.
Right. It is.
Yeah. I feel like it's kind of inevitable. I mean, of course, you still got to make like a proper game. I mean, you can't just make something that's like targeted at a younger audience and will blow up. But if you do like the right things, it's kind of inevitable that it will blow up. And I don't know if you just, I feel like if you just focus on that too much, yeah, I mean, it's going to turn out, it's going to be a game that you don't really enjoy working on at some point.
I mean,
anymore.
Yeah.
I see that. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, at some point, you know, if your whole, if your whole design philosophy is making something that's going to hit on YouTube, it seems like that's a road that ends up with you begging MatPat on Twitter to do a game theory video about your game. But no, indies for me, you know, before I was with Dread XP, I did Horror You Haven't Played, and I still run that account, and I still look at a lot of indie horror. I have a video series that covers indie horror. I live and breathe indie horror. And to me, I've always enjoyed the indies because it feels like a repudiation of the AAA mindset. Like Ted was saying, Ubisoft will put out, you know, they're like, oh, this game, the main character is from a broken home. It's fine, you can tell me that, but the gameplay is still a Far Cry game. Like, it does nothing new. But whenever you go to the indie spaces, people are making unique experiences, and they're not always going to hit. Once again, going back to what Ted said, you know, for every Bastion, you have 2,000 equally great games that aren't going to get that exposure. And that's why I think that spaces like Haunted PS1 and places like Dread XP that are putting this focus on indie and helping elevate it are the way to go in the future.
Jans, I already pay you. You don't have to. You don't have to keep saying nice.
Shut up, Ted. Shut up. No, I'm just saying, like, a single, and I hate to say this, but it is a harsh truth that I need the indie devs out there to know. It is hard as fuck to do it by yourself. It's
Yep. I really, really, I totally agree that. I really, really try my best to promote the idea of positive, active cooperation. Because, like, it's really fucking easy for indie devs that are working to tear each other apart in private and in public to, like, be like, oh, yeah, your game is great, but then, like, not buy it. And, like, that's the thing that really, really annoys me about, like, game devs marketing and game dev circles is that, like, you know, you'll get so many people be like, oh, your game looks so cool. All these upvotes, all these likes, all these people being like, yeah, this is so cool. And then they won't fucking buy your goddamn game. And, you know, devs need to eat. And so I always try to like push like, hey, you know, like what you need to do is instead of just going out there and like paying lip service to these games, you know, like if you're wanting to support them, then like go buy them or, you know, encourage your friends to actually buy them. Like, and I know that everyone's at different levels of economic prosperity, but at the same time, I think that like that also makes sure that like your public persona is like, you know, matching your private persona. Because like, I think that so often like people get like these toxic elements and communities can grow because of like lack of understanding or assuming bad faith on the other part. And like the only thing I would say is that like I always try to assume other people have good intentions because I would like them to do that for me. And it's just like a kindness I do to others to like, because I think it's unkind to assume that someone has like bad intentions. So sorry, like I said, I'm rambling again. But I think that like the ethos for indie should always be, you know, let's find ways to elevate each other rather than try to cut each other down. And I think that oftentimes that ethos kind of gets lost in the competitive nature of indie, but I think that, you know, indie can do a lot more than coming together. I mean, just look at the demo disc. It's like, you know, the demo disc gets so many more eyes than any of those individual projects ever could, you know?
Yeah,
and totally. For me, you know, if an indie dev, and you should all know this by now if you interact with me at all, if you hit me up and you say, I want you to look at this, I guarantee I'm going to look at it. I don't throw anything out. I give time to everything that comes to me. And there are ways that I can promote or kind of signal boost your stuff. I wouldn't say as a kindness, because it's not a favor if you're making something amazing. I want to talk about it. You know, with the Highwall loophole, I was like, I could write a review. I could write a feature. And then I was like, oh, I can have Jamathan on the podcast because I like the work that he's done on this game. And it's just that kind of community. We all need to be lifting each other up, in private and, you know, on a grander scale. And I think, like I was saying a moment ago, it's hard to do it alone. You might want to go it alone and go, I'm just going to do this all myself. There's a lot more that goes into it. You know, like Ted was touching on, you might have your fellow dev friend saying, oh, this is amazing. They're not going to buy your game. You need to kind of foster these relationships, and tearing each other down won't help anything. Yeah. We'll just end up with we'll just end up.
Sorry,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say tearing each other down just leads to like a giant contingent of jaded, pissed off game devs, and nothing good comes out of that.
Yeah. I think on this, like on the Highwall loophole, this was the first time. Well, actually, not the first time. Like on the Backrooms game, I've also collaborated with someone who basically wrote the entire like story, like you find across the tapes and stuff. And that was, I guess, that was my first project that actually had like some kind of story in it. But this one is different because I collaborated with Quinn Kay. She was the lead dev on An Outcry, which you probably have seen as well, floating around. And like, she helped me out a lot in figuring out like what kind of direction I wanted to take the story. And like a lot of the story elements, honestly, the story is not conveyed super well in the game. I'm going to be honest about that. It's not very proud about that, but just the core idea that there is a story and that I have basically the entire story like written down somewhere is all thanks to her, because if I hadn't done this, the game probably wouldn't be the same, because I wouldn't have had any ideas on where to take certain things. And when I've had any idea on like, yeah, basically how to move the game forward, if that makes any sense. Like I had like the first area of the game done, and I had basically no idea where to take it from there. And then thanks to her, I had like a bunch of ideas, and I was able to, you know, make it into something that feels like it has some kind of a story behind it, at least. So
yeah, I've seen some,
yeah, moral of his story is just work with people. That's really cool.
Yeah, I've seen some buzz about An Outcry, and I'd like to get her on at some point to talk about An Outcry, but yeah. We are approaching the end of our hour. We've actually passed the end of our hour, but I'm not going to worry too much about it. But Jamathan, can you give us a tease? Are you planning anything for the 2022 demo disc?
I wish I could say that I was. I'm honestly in like a massive inspirational drought right now. Like I've got a bunch of stuff that I would like to work on. But I know, honestly, I don't really have anything I can talk about because I don't know myself. I really hope I can do something for the demo disc though. I mean,
an open world survival crafting MMO, it'll be easy.
That sounds really good. I'm sure I'll do that.
Yeah, it's so easy.
Yeah.
So post launch, it seems like inspiration drought is a real ass thing post launch. So, you know, take some time to yourself, you know, drink a hot tea. Go down to the market square and
treat yourself.
Yeah, go get you some
munchies.
Yeah.
At the fucking Dread XP office, every time we relaunch a game, it's like we get 3 days of like the hardest partying of our lives basically right after that, and then it's basically just back to work. Because like my team doesn't get to sleep because like we have another game to fucking push almost immediately. You know,
What? Post launch on Sucker for Love was dope though. We just kinda hung out
I was so good.
Yeah, we hung out in voice chat and we watched movies, we played some games together, we just kinda just fucking unwind, and then we're all back at it within a couple days. But
you ever want to know what the ethos is or what it's like where you get Jet XP and any of our listeners, it's 14 hour days until we finally get something out, and then we all lose our minds for about a week just like fucking just watching movies and playing games and getting stoned.
Yeah, just chilling. Yeah. It's like, right. It's like, so I want to know if you had the same feeling before I get into my closing stuff. Jamathan, whenever you launched, like, did launch the day before launch, did it kind of feel like Christmas Eve where you're like, oh, big thing tomorrow?
Yeah, but definitely felt more like Christmas than actual Christmas usually does.
Yeah, actually, I was going to say for Sucker for Love. Sucker for Love was like my first full launch working full-time for Dread XP, so I was like, I was so hype, and then launch happens, and we, you know, we hang out in Twitch streams, and we check Steam forums, and, you know, just kind of the post-launch support. It's, I don't know, it's something that is unique to the games industry that I hadn't got to have before, and it was very cool.
Yeah. Aww.
It's yeah, always
that's so cute.
I'm very ready for the next launch. What is our next launch?
Oh God, there's like three different titles possibly, but we need to figure that.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I think.
Say so. Just
yeah, like, I'm not sure. What the exact?
It'll either be Spookware or the next collection.
Yeah, I know. I was gonna say. I know it's in the pipeline. I just don't know which one's gonna come first. Either one, though. Very excited about that. But Jamathan, where can we find you on the internet at large? Please plug your stuff.
Mostly on Twitter, honestly. I guess I could just say it in German. So the German version is at Muddychick. And I'm not even going to pronounce that in English because it's gonna suck. Yeah, that's basically it. I'm not really active anywhere else. I really want to do some, like, I've been thinking about doing YouTube stuff for so long, but I don't know. I really hate making videos. Like, it takes so long. And
for developer stuff?
Yeah, like devlogs and stuff.
Oh, do it. Know. Very, very, a little trick for you and your developer friends out there. Dev logs on YouTube work. Please do them. If you want some more attention on your game, definitely look into doing dev diaries on the YouTubes. They definitely help.
And pop over to the Dread XP YouTube. The dev diaries that we're putting up, they're not, you know, 40-minute long in-depth things. They're just kind of little fun dev diaries, you know, 4 minutes or so, 4 or 5 minutes. Something short form like that.
You could post a video, yeah. You could post a video of you, like, maybe pooping or farting in a cup, and people would be like, wow, this is so cool. Because they just want to see, like, developers and videos. Like, they just... And this is a lot for, like, interested fans or aspiring indie developers, so... You're reaching all kinds of people with dev diaries.
Yeah, Stroboscop made a video like a minute long. Minute long video of him making a
so good if you haven't seen it
of
yet.
Him making a rat in ZBrush and then rigging and adding an animation to it, and he just kind of narrated what he was doing, and it's up on our TikTok, and people love stuff like that. And something as simple as, you know, I'm making a rat in ZBrush. Here's what I'm going to do to rig it. I did the rigging wrong.
How do I get the rat to explode? What does an exploded rat look like?
Yeah, it's fun stuff. But yeah, you can go to Twitter to follow Jamathan at... I'm going to mispronounce this.
Here it comes.
You can go there.
Wait, I want to see it. Where did you link it? I want to see it.
Oh, I just know his Twitter handle.
I can put it in the chat.
Yeah, put it in chat. I want to
because I follow him on Twitter. I have for a long, long time now.
Was it Malishek? Malishek?
Malishek.
That's pretty much right. Yeah.
Damn, and I know a good amount of German, and I still didn't get that right.
I don't think that's German actually. I don't know what that is, but it's probably not
Polish.
German.
Ted's using his Polish powers because he speaks a fair amount of Polish.
I speak like the alphabet. Like, I'm really bad at it. I'm really bad at languages. Don't come at me asking about language stuff. I'm really bad at it.
Ted, where can we find you on the internet at large?
Henschke. That's my Twitter handle. I rarely tweet. But every time I do, it's fire. So you should follow me.
And Abby, where can we find you on the internet at large?
You can find me on Twitter at ScrunchOG, Instagram at Scruncho.Speakeasy, and TikTok at Speakeasy.
And I'm going to say this again. I've done this for like the last five podcasts. Yeah, exactly. Deal with it, Abby. Deal with the promotion. We just talked about lifting up other creators. Jesus Christ.
I love you too, Jan.
Abby has an album out called Prohibition Hippie. You can get it wherever. You can get it at Tower Records, if those exist anymore. No, wherever that you find music, it is like dream pop. It's real, I don't know, I can't explain it. It's real chill music for like working or working out or driving your car. Just anything you want to do in your life. Prohibition Hippie. You can find it where music is sold. That's my Abby plug, because she won't do it. She won't promote herself. you can find me on Twitter at DreadXP _, or on my personal account at HorrorPlayed, where I've mostly been talking about, I think my last tweet said this hole was made for me, and then I described climbing into the mouth of a Chuck E. Cheese suit while a terrified teenager inside tries to get me to stop. Dude. You can find us at DreadXP Games on Instagram, at DreadXP Games on TikTok, and DreadXP on Facebook, if you are Polish. Our Facebook is for the Poles only. It's not, it's for everybody, but the Polish seem to like it. But
exactly.
Thank you for coming on, Jamathan. I love having on developers talking about sound design and things like that. So, Jamathan, play us out.
What?